You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, March 5th, 2012. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, an interview I did late last week with Seth Wessler, investigative reporter on colorlines.com, about a really interesting piece he did on the victims of the NYPD spying scandal. Spying on just all sorts of Muslims, college students. You don't even have to be in New York City. They'll come to you no matter what university you're going to in the greater Northeast. Also on the program today, it's Monday, which is apparently National Drop Rush Limbaugh radio program if you're a sponsor day. I think we're up to 8 national sponsors saying goodbye to Rush Limbaugh. We'll talk more about that on the program. Over the weekend, President Obama speaks to AIPAC, frothing right-wing Israel supporters demanding war against Iran. President not willing to go there quite yet. We'll talk about that. Also, more notice on the bank foreclosures. Interesting story in the New York Times, except for it left out the most important aspect of the story. We'll dig into that. And today is also, Mondays are really hopping around here. Not only is it my sister's birthday, so happy birthday to my sister. It's also the day that the United States is going to announce how it justifies the targeting killing of citizens around the world. U.S. citizens. What a wonderful day. We will get to that. And then, of course, later in the program, your phone calls at 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. You can IM me at Majority FM. It is Monday. I will be on the Dylan Radigan program this afternoon. And I believe it being Monday, March 5th, tomorrow is Tuesday, or Super Tuesday, March 6th, a big primary for the Republican guys who will never be president. And it will probably resolve the question, who will get to spend more money in pursuit of a job you'll never get? And as such, it appears, these things don't always get nailed down, but I will be sitting in with a Chris Hayes helmed panel at midnight tomorrow night. So I don't know. I guess tomorrow I do the show, then I go home. I do some Ring of Fire, then I go home and take a nap. I don't know how this is going to work out, folks. I'm going to be tired. So yesterday, in celebration of Bibi Netanyahu's trip to the United States, some former military officials decided that it was necessary on behalf of the National Iranian American Council to actually take out a full-page ad saying that we shouldn't have a war with choice with Iran. Just to let you know how sort of bizarre this has all gotten. But better, you know, this is the preemptive advertising campaign to stop the preemptive, or I should say not even preemptive. It's the preemptive advertising campaign to stop the preventative war that some on the right would have us wage. It included Major General Paul Eaton, Lieutenant General Robert G. Gard, Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. He got burned once on that whole Iraq thing. You'll remember he was Colin Powell's assistant. There were more military personnel who basically said, hey, you know, this whole thing where we're supposedly going to encourage an Israeli bombing of Iran, probably not a good idea. Spencer Ackerman breaks down Obama's AIPAC speech. The big thing that people are pointing towards, or to, I should say. And of course, you understand that if you're an American politician, for whatever reason, you have to sort of play along with AIPAC, I guess. They set the playing field that the notion of Iran having a nuclear weapon is de facto a threat to our national security. I haven't seen the argument other than, well, they're crazy. And Ahmadinejad, who really doesn't run the country, you understand that, right? It's the Supreme Ayatollah who runs the country. But Ahmadinejad once said something vaguely to the effect of, we want to wipe Israel off of a map. And because of that, if Iran gets a nuclear weapon, it is de facto an existential threat to both Israel and to America. Although nobody can sort of game out how it happens that the Iranians launch a missile with a nuclear weapon, and then they somehow put up, I guess, some type of force field around their country. I don't know. I haven't quite worked that part out yet. So Obama went in front of AIPAC, and he said, I made a commitment to the American people and said that we would use all elements of American power to pressure Iran and prevent it from acquiring a nuclear weapon. Apparently, that statement is actually sort of a positive one for those of us who are not in favor of a needless war of choice with Iran. Or I should say at least a foolhardy war of choice with Iran. I guess Netanyahu wants the United States to pressure Iran and prevent it from acquiring the know-how and the capacity to produce a nuclear weapon, as opposed to actually producing one. In other words, Netanyahu wants us to effectively eliminate every aspect of the infrastructure, including the mental infrastructure that could exist in Iran that could lead to the building of a nuclear weapon. Which I guess would mean also sort of doing something about all those loose nukes that are in the former Soviet Union. But of course, we won't do that. So some people are speculating that basically Obama has sort of put Netanyahu in a box, making it harder for Netanyahu to attack Iran unilaterally. Professor Juan Cole has a great piece out on the top 10 dangers for Obama of Iran sanctions on behalf of Israel. Because, of course, there is no proof that Iran is a existential threat to our country. Number one basic problem with dire sanctions regime like the one imposed on Iraq and now on Iran is that it can kill a lot of innocent civilians, including children. Some estimates that the U.S. UN sanctions killed about 500,000 Iraqi children in the 1990s. And number two, in turn, when you kill a lot of innocent children, apparently, Arab and Muslim children, apparently Arab and Muslims around the world sort of don't think it's appropriate. And maybe even arguably some non-Arabs and non-Muslims think it's inappropriate. The Obama sanctions are turning into collective punishment of civilian populations, which is illegal, as if that were an issue for our foreign policy. Number three, onerous sanctions do not remove a regime or cause it to change policies, since the elite can cushion themselves from the effect. I would argue, and then I guess as number four, Juan Cole does, in fact, as the urban middle class decline, they lose the wherewithal to challenge the government. Authoritarianism is strengthened by sanctions, not weakened. Case in point, Cuba. How's that sanctions regime gone? It's not even effective 50 years later when Castro's almost dead. The only time I think sanctions has in any way hurt a country, as far as I know, just off the top of my head, I'm sure there are other examples, but I think the threat of sanctions, or at least private sanctions, weakened the South African regime. But that was because they had such a they were relying on such a minority of the people in the country as their support base. And the vast majority of people in the country were already so poor, they were gaining no benefit from any foreign trade. Number five, a feeling of being under siege also causes populations to rally around even an unpopular government. Number six, wide-ranging and deep sanctions can bleed over into the sort of blockade. Blockades are a casus belli in international law and very frequently provoke wars. Number seven, Israeli agents of influence attempt to keep America talking about anything but Israel's own ongoing crimes against humanity with regard to the Palestinians. Yeah. I think that's probably a huge part of the reason why you hear people like Netanyahu talking about Iran so much, because when you have your own domestic issues, the best thing to do is to talk about the boogeyman who's going to invade the country. It works both ways. A regime of sanctions strengthens Iranian leaders, just like the threat of an Iranian attack strengthens Israelis' leaders. It's always whenever you're in deep doo-doo with domestic problems, the best thing to do is to talk about the threat from the outside. Heck, even George Bush figured that out. And he's an idiot. Number eight, we were told that the road to peace between Israelis and Palestinians ran through Baghdad. It was a bald-faced lie, a magician's piece of misdirection. In other words, we can talk about the Iranian influence on Hezbollah and Hamas all we want. But the problem between the Israeli and the Palestinians will only be solved between the Israelis and Palestinians. U.S. interests are directly and very negatively affected by Washington's collusion with Israel in keeping the Palestinians stateless and without basic human rights. Indeed. And number 10, because misdirection on this very large scale is a little difficult, the U.S. is thrown by such an endeavor into being a propaganda state, which is bad for public policy in general. In other words, it doesn't help to be pretending that there's no problem with Israel's relationship with the Palestinians and focus on Iran. It just doesn't help. And, of course, Glenn Greenwald has a piece up about the limited debate that takes place in this country. I think I said this when I was on Pete Dominic show. And even Pete, who is a fairly reasonable guy, when I said, like, when was the last time you heard a debate about whether or not it really is a significant security threat for Iran, to this country, for Iran to have a nuclear weapon? I mean, of course, we don't want more and more countries to have nuclear weapons. We should want less and less countries to have nuclear weapons. And more countries to have less. You know, we don't need to be able to blow up the world 70, 100 times, what is it, 1,000 times over. That's probably not necessary. There's no evil scientist trying to make multiple worlds so that if we blow up the first one, there'll be even more. I'm trying to do my Doobenshmirtz from Phineas and Ferb. The tri-state area. And, of course, we are talking about the idea of striking Iran is not a preemptive war. Neither was the one in Iraq. It's a preventative war. In other words, this is the functional equivalent of, you know, we're going to kill all the firstborn of our slaves so that they can't rise up against us 50 years in the future, 30 years in the future. This will continue. I am not of the mind that we're actually going to see a war with Iran. And I tend to doubt even we're going to see Israel bomb Iran. But I think it's necessary to call out the BS that we're being fed on a constant basis. The Washington Post, I think, had a piece today supposedly quoting some general saying, you know, it'd be pretty easy to do this. A couple of bunker busters in there, and then magic happens, and everything turns out okay. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, my interview that I did for Ring of Fire over the weekend with Seth Wessler on the NYPD's spying program against Muslims in our own country. It's preventative spying. These college students, God knows what they're doing there. God knows. Going on whitewater rafting trips? Right, as if. As if Muslim students would go on a white... Who's heard of such a thing? We all know that only the Christian fellowship groups go on whitewater rafting trips, not other groups. Who's ever heard of anything like that? That's crazy. Of course you need to spy on these people. Also on the program today, I will get into this whole Rush Limbaugh thing and give you a suggestion on how you can get in on the game, one which I actually think is far more effective than going after his national advertisers. And later in the better half of the program, I will do another random Rush segment. It'll be fun to dip into Rush's show for 60 seconds and see what he is ranting on about. I bet you it has to do with the First Amendment. And we'll talk about his apology, which is wonderful to hear that he's apologizing as empty and disingenuous of an apology as it is. And remember, folks, the only way this show exists, because I don't rely on corporate advertising, is by your membership. So if you can, please become a member today at majority.fm. We'll be back with this interview short with Lee. Had a dream, it was about nothing. Take the skinheads falling, take them bowling. 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 So, Seth, first let's start by... Give us a little bit of background here. The AP has done extensive reporting over the past couple of months regarding what it's learned about the New York Police Department and its program of of spying, essentially, on Muslims. I mean, it seems sort of naked just to say it that way, but that's basically what it comes down to, isn't it?
Well, it's become absolutely clear over the last several months, as the AP has released this series of investigative pieces, that the New York City Police Department is engaged in a practice of blatant religious and ethnic profiling of Muslims, not just in the city of New York, but also all over the northeastern part of the United States, into Connecticut, Philadelphia, New Jersey. And the NYPD is conducting this surveillance and is spying on Muslim communities in all parts of people's lives, going into bodegas, into community centers, into restaurants, into mosques while people are praying, filming cars that are coming to those mosques and taking down license plate numbers, even documenting a small privately owned African-American Muslim school for kids who are under about 11 years old in Newark, New Jersey, and then constructing extensive databases and lists of all of these places, all of these people. It is a striking amount of energy that's been put into this surveillance, this spying program. And it's really struck fear into communities all over the region.
I mean, there's a couple of things that we should make absolutely clear here. These are complete fishing expeditions. In other words, this isn't a situation of the New York Police Department following a lead that starts in New York City and following it, say, to Connecticut, to Boston, to New Hampshire or Maine or to New Jersey or Pennsylvania. This is the New York Police Department sort of just spreading out. Is that right?
The New York Police Department has nothing to support, has no evidence of wrongdoing for this in implementing this program. I mean, we're talking about following people into their classes on college campuses. We're talking about documenting everybody who prays in a mosque, writing down the name of a school for 11-year-olds, for 5-year-olds in Newark, New Jersey. I mean, there's absolutely no evidence of wrongdoing whatsoever. It is absolutely a fishing expedition. New York City Police Department says that it only follows legitimate leads. It's simply a lie. They are not following legitimate leads. They're trying to wholesale spy on Muslim communities. You know, one of the stories that came out of one of the AP stories, a Muslim student group from the City College of New York went on a rafting trip in a sort of, you know, orientation kind of thing where they were going rafting upstate New York. Well, an informant for the New York City Police Department followed these students and wrote down everything that they said on that trip, noting that in his notes that he handed in afterwards, that the students prayed 4 times a day. Of course, that's wrong. Many Muslims pray 5 times a day, and so, you know, it's in addition to being absolutely egregious from a civil liberties perspective, there's also just a sort of incredible ignorance on the part of those engaged in this work.
I want to talk about some of the specific investigations that you write about in your piece in a minute, but now, from a jurisdictional standpoint, how is it that the New York City Police Department has the jurisdiction to go outside of New York City, to go outside of New York State, and surveil people? I mean, don't they need to? Are they issuing warrants here? Are they getting court orders that allow them to do this? Are they completely freelancing? I mean, under what authority does the New York Police Department travel outside of the state to essentially just surveil?
Look, I mean, these questions are the questions that everybody's asking right now, including, for example, the mayor of Newark, New Jersey, the head of Yale University, who are all saying, what are you doing in our backyards writing down the names of everybody who happens to be Muslim here? There are absolutely jurisdictional issues that emerge here. There are questions of constitutional questions, even more broadly than that, about religious and ethnic-based profiling, about investigations that are that aren't based on evidence of wrongdoing. The legal questions here are going to start, start emerging in real form very soon. And I think, the legal groups are just figuring out what to do, how to take this on. I mean, the scale of the violations here, both from a civil liberties perspective and also, as you say, from a jurisdictional perspective, are really mammoth.
And we also know that the division of the New York Police Department that is engaging in this spying, surveilling, because it's hard to sort of call this police work, if we were to call this police work, that would be the functional equivalent of, spying on people who you might think have a reason to steal, spy on people who you might think have a reason to engage in any other type of crime, which would, theoretically could open it up to a whole raft of people. But this spying, what division of the police department is engaged in this?
Well, first of all, I think you're making a really good point about this being just sort of off the wall. But, the New York City Police Department is operating with a sort of out of control theory about how violence happens, about how terrorism happens, which basically boils down to the idea that as people become more religious, as they become more actively Muslim, that they are therefore fundamentally more likely to commit violence and commit acts of terrorism. It is a sort of the basis of theories of policing. It's based on the theory of radicalization that spread pretty rapidly all over the country and in Europe, and it's absolutely unjustifiable. But I think that's what the New York City Police is operating on. The New York City Police has what's called a demographics unit. It's a unit that's set up to actually track people on a demographic basis, on the basis of religion in this case, and they have been mapping and creating and constructing databases to do just that. But I want to add that the New York City's sort of domestic anti-terrorism work sprawls throughout its the New York City Police Department, and it is massively funded. We recently learned that the White House is in fact funding the NYPD in part to conduct some of this surveillance through an old drug war era program that's now being sort of misallocated toward this work. But there's also millions upon millions and millions of dollars that have come for the last decade have come from the Department of Homeland Security that are being funneled into the New York City Police Department. It's not very clear to anybody how that money is being used. And what we're seeing now is that the New York City Police Department has this massive infrastructure in place that it's using however it sees fit to essentially to expand itself outwardly to ends that we probably haven't even seen yet. Beyond the Northeast, the NYPD has agents in other countries around the world doing this work. Jurisdictional questions start to spread on and on and on and on.
Specifically talking about that, the revelation this past week that there was is basically drug war money being used to spy on Muslims. Mm-hmm. Do we know if the administration has been aware of the use of this money, or is this? In other words, it appears that we have the reporting that I've read suggests that you have NYPD officers under the auspices of this drug war organization, essentially, administration agency, using the email addresses, using the database, using funds that they buy cars ostensibly to track drug dealers, and then using them for these spying activities. Do we know if the administration was, A, aware of the use of these funds for these spying activities, and B, do we know whether or not this was an attempt by the New York City Police Department to hide its activities by doing it under the auspices of a different agency?
We do not know what the federal government knew. Specifically, we don't know what the White House knew about what was going on. The White House has refused to comment on the program, has refused to come out and comment explicitly on the program. We did hear yesterday that Attorney General Holder is considering the possibility of looking into and investigating these practices, but it's not clear, in fact, if that will move forward. I mean, what is absolutely clear is that the federal government more broadly, beyond the White House and drug enforcement program that got spent on this sort of domestic counterterrorism work that ends up looking like and is, in fact, wholesale spying. Beyond that, the Department of Homeland Security has been funding NYPD and funds lots of agencies around the country to do this kind of work. Now, the NYPD has taken this to another level. Right. You know,
all right, Seth, let's take a break here. And when we come back, let's talk about that level in which the NYPD is taking this, because these stories of just you write about exactly talk to some of the victims, essentially, of this NYPD spying campaign. And I want to talk about that when we come back. When we broke, we basically talked about the reporting that we're aware of up at this point, that the NYPD has been engaged in a wholesale spying program for years now that have taken them well outside of the confines of New York City, well outside of the confines of New York State, to simply surveil seemingly random Muslims across the Northeast. And I say random because you document and you've spoken to some of the victims of these spying, and many of them that you come across talk about instances where they've been spied upon literally from a distance and up close with people posing as students or fellow mosque goers. And then these spies essentially disappear. Tell me about the people that you spoke to and what they've been subjected to.
Well, I mean, I've been talking to people all over New York and the region, and I spoke to a lot of students who are students on the campuses of colleges and universities where the New York City Police Department has been spying on Muslim student associations.
What campuses are those? Tell me some of those, because I think people are going to be surprised.
Yale, NYU, Rutgers, Columbia. Many of the State University of New York schools, almost all of the City University of New York colleges, University of Pennsylvania, and on, 16 campuses, at least 16 campuses around the region where the New York police have been spying on both the sort of internet exchanges and activities of students, but also actively spying on entering into community spaces, into joining Muslim student associations, and pretending to be members of those organizations. In one instance that...
Let me just say at this point that it is impossible to imagine that the New York Police Department had leads that took them to over 16 college campuses with no connection between those college campuses around the Northeast. It's impossible to imagine that they had leads that brought them specifically there. They're clearly just hitting every university and college that they can.
There were absolutely no specific leads. The leads were that there were Muslim students on these campuses. That's what brought the NYPD to these campuses. They could have gone to every campus in the Northeast looking for Muslims. Their assumption is, their working assumption is, which we can see demonstrated in their practices, is that Muslims fundamentally pose a threat to community safety, to national security. I mean, you know, this would never be considered if we were talking about another religious group here. But, you know, the New York City Police Department's practices are essentially a microcosm of what's happened since September 11th vis-a-vis Muslim communities, where civil liberties are violated in sort of wholesale ways. And the New York City Police is showing itself to be amongst the most egregious offenders here. You know, I also want to note that the New York City Police Department claims that all of this surveillance work is preventing acts of terrorism. Well, you know, I tried to track down what they were talking about. And in numerous of the instances that New York City has cited, instances where they said they foiled plots of violence, they've actually used informants who have entered into communities, targeted vulnerable young men who are otherwise sort of disgruntled, made up plots, pushed them on these young men, and then arrested them once these young men tried to enact the very plots that never were going to happen. So we're talking about what's essentially here entrapment. That's where this can lead to, and it has led to. There are people who are now incarcerated for 30 years after being essentially entrapped by the NYPD. And then, you know, in order to do that, the New York City Police Department's been spying on what seems to be thousands and thousands and thousands of Muslims around the region.
It really is stunning. And just briefly, the story that you talk about where you had these students who were going on the rafting trip. Well, I'm not sure we have time to go into it fully, but just briefly, just give us just a quick update about Jawad Razul, who believes that the NYPD tried to set him up before that City College rafting trip.
That's right. The story I wrote for colorlines.com tells the story of Jawad Razul, who was followed with his Muslim Student Association, with other students, on this rafting trip. That was recorded and the AP reported it. But several years before that, he was actually befriended by a man who, it turned out, was an informant for the New York police who had entrapped another young man, convincing him to be a lookout for a plot that was never going to happen. This guy, Jawad Razul, who I spoke with, you know, said he was never at risk of being in trap because he would never have agreed to anything. But nonetheless, he now knows that he's been followed repeatedly for absolutely no good reason. You know, he said to me that he now, to deal with this, has decided to post everything that he does all the time on Facebook and make that public so that the police aren't surprised by anything, so that he can get ahead of them and say, this is where I am, I'm not up to anything. I mean, this is the kind of fear that these policies have thrown into Muslim communities all over the region.
Well, I encourage people to go read your piece, Seth, because that aspect of what it's done to the humanity and to the psychology of these students and just these completely innocent people is really what is so egregious about this. Aside from the implications of what it means for all of our civil rights, I appreciate your time on this.
Thanks so much for having me on.
All right, folks, we will put a link at majority.fm to Seth's piece because you really got to sort of – he gets some personal reactions from some of these students who are being spied upon. And it really is just – I can't even imagine how destructive it is to a 20-year-old's life, really, that you go to college – you've made it to an Ivy League school or a top university. That part in and of itself is hard for me to imagine. You've worked hard to get to school and to you're going to have a sort of positive, productive future, and then you become incredibly paranoid because you have spent 6 months hanging out with a guy who turns out to be a cop and is spying on you. That one kid who now, like, wherever he goes, kid, I guess, is, you know, probably in his early 20s, but posts everything on Facebook so that he's not flagging, his activities don't seem suspicious to the cops. So it's just unbelievable. It's just unbelievable, the destruction that is wreaked. And, you know, so much of this is a function of our overfunding of local police forces and state police, whatever it is. We've got a, and not just with no oversight, but because, you know, all this Homeland Security money,
all this money that's being diverted into these police departments. We've got a video up of a protest that took place on Saturday, I believe it was, in Virginia. And I don't know how many people it was, maybe 500. It's hard to say. Maybe 1,000. The most benign, suburban-looking people. I mean, I guess if I saw this group of people, well, you know, marching towards me, I'd get nervous. But that's because I get nervous when I see suburban people marching, or just suburban. When I see suburban, you know, it's like going to a mall. I get anxiety attacks. They're marching on the Virginia State House. Some of the people go and sit on the steps of the State House. And the force they are met with, you've got state police cops in these sort of Cylon-looking outfits with shields and full armor, body armor. And then behind them, sitting on the steps with automatic weaponry, is a team of about, I don't know, a dozen. They look like paramilitary, but they must be just SWAT. They're in green sort of quasi fatigues. It's really more like these body armor outfits, just sitting there with automatic weaponry. And Hillary has a good point. I don't even know if the Capitol is even open on Saturday. So the threat here is what? Is what? I mean, you're really talking. You got to look at this video. It is the most benign group of people you could imagine, holding signs, and they are met with a team of semi-automatic weapons and dogs. All right, we've got to take a break, head into the better half of the program. Coming up in the better half of the program, more, I think now we're up to 8. I mean, they're dropping like flies, the national advertisers for the Rush Limbaugh show. And I will do a random Rush live. I mean, I always do it live, but I usually record it in the past. But I'm going to do random Rush in the better half of the program today, just to see what this guy is. God knows what he's moaning about today. Remember, also an update on the targeted killing. We're going to find out today how we decide, or supposedly find out how we decide, you know, when we're going to assassinate a U.S. citizen. Fun stuff today, folks. So fun. And I'm going to get to that judge who sent a racist email and said, well, if it was private, it wouldn't have been racist. I'm paraphrasing. Please become a member. Please become a member of the show. Congratulations to the Bill Press Show and to the Stephanie Miller Show. We're now making the 6 to noon makeup of current programming. I don't think that's happening with me, folks. The show will rely on your membership. Also, you can support the show by giving us a good review on iTunes. Or if you buy junk through from Amazon, buy it through our link. Just go to majority.fm, click support the show, click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, always buy your Amazon junk through there. We get kickbacks. Huge, massive kickbacks. Also, don't forget, donateyouraccount.com. You can donate one tweet a day, one Facebook post a day, or one a week, or one a month, whatever you prefer. People love it. And we have merch available on our site. And, of course, justcoffee.coop, fair trade, coffee, tea, chocolate. 10% discount with the coupon code MAJORITY. See you in the better half.